From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners just like you. Please visit stateofbelief.com and help keep this show on the air. The shakeup at the Westboro Baptist Church, inspiration for World Water Week, and the Supremes take up a hobby. That's what's coming up in the next hour on State of Belief Radio.
The Supreme Court will have to consider two tricky legal questions. One is whether for-profit corporations have a right to religious freedom. The other is whether business owners' rights come before those of their employees.
The recent radical redefinition of religious liberty faces a crucial test this week as the U.S. Supreme Court hears arguments in Sebelius versus Hobby Lobby stores. It's a crucial constitutional test of how completely personal religious convictions can insulate a corporation from a legal mandate. And I'll talk about what a big deal this ruling may turn out to be with author and activist Jay Michelson on this week's show.
A large percentage of the world doesn't have clean drinking water, and I'd never really thought about world issues before. What started out as a mission to drill a clean water well in Africa became a generosity movement.
As completely as you and I are able to take access to clean water for granted, 780 million people on this planet, more than 2.5 times the total U.S. population, simply do not have that kind of access to clean water. While that large number can be paralyzing to some, others are chipping away at it in selfless and inspiring ways. March 22nd has been designated World Water Day, and later in the show, you'll meet the founder of an extraordinary effort to combat the water crisis that's facing so many, Ali Eastburn of With This Ring. But first,
you are Satan's evangelist, spreading the devil's lies. Meanwhile, we at Westboro Baptist Church are offering up special prayers for you. They are prayers for God's curses to be poured out upon a class of very grievous sinners, that God will kill them and remove such evil people from the earth. We are praying this kind of imprecatory prayers for Anderson Cooper. Amen.
This week, headlines blared that pastor of Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps Sr., had died amidst a power struggle going on within that tiny organization. Dr. Rebecca Barrett Fox teaches at Arkansas State University, with the title of her dissertation being, now get this, "Pray Not for This People for Their Good, Westboro Baptist Church, the Religious Right, and American Nationalism." Obviously, Dr. Barrett Fox is in a unique position to analyze the present and future of the notorious Westboro Baptist Church. I'm very glad to be able to welcome Dr. Rebecca Barrett Fox to State of Belief Radio. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
What in the world drew you to study Westboro?
It's a great question. I was living in Lawrence, Kansas, which is about 30 miles from Topeka, where the church is located, as a graduate student. I had interest in religion and studying religion, and I'd also spent a lot of time previous to this doing field research in various churches, just in some ways as a hobby. Mm-hmm. I was really interested in religious variety and religious conservatism. I had been in college leading up to Y2K and was doing a lot of research on rural churches and concerns about Y2K, and we kind of laugh at them now, but a lot of churches at that time were preaching kind of apocalyptic messages.
Right.
And so I was pretty comfortable in conservative churches and with the language of conservative churches as a scholar. And I thought, boy, you know, I've seen Westboro Baptist Church on television, and I'd seen them in person in particular because they picket around Kansas frequently. And I thought, I can't live so close and not visit the church. And so I very naively decided to go and visit the church. And I say naively because I thought, well, I'll just blend in, you know, I'll just sit in the back and nobody will notice me. And of course, that's not the case. It's a small congregation. Just even visually, all the women have uncut hair and wear head coverings during the church service. So it was clear, you know, that I didn't belong there. I had seen them on the picket line, and, you know, they're so abrasive and confrontational, and the language is so shocking. But I thought, surely that won't be what it's like in church, because why spiritually would you come back Sunday after Sunday to hear this same message? Mm-hmm. And in that first sermon, I was really struck that it was the same intensity. And what I didn't know at the time was the preaching logic and themes that are really central to hyper-Calvinism. Mm-hmm. And so the services would start out with a prayer, something like, Dear God, thank you that we're inside this church, like we're not like those people outside of those church who are going to hell, but here inside this church we have a hope for going to heaven. And just perpetually reinforcing this insider-outsider boundary, I was really struck by the intensity of feelings in those church services. There was lots of children, all of whom were attentive. There's a lot of loving interaction, though, between parents and children. You didn't hear any kids, you know, outside getting spanked or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Everyone was really focused on the sermon and attuned to what was going on. And I thought, I could understand why a person wants to be here, because if you're in this group, you know, if you're on the inside and you get the jokes and you're fluent in the language of this type of service, it would feel very affirming because you're perpetually told that this is the safe place to be. Mm-hmm. So I would continue to go back just for observation and then realize that this is what I had wanted to do my doctoral work on. In the middle of my work, they began picketing military funerals.
Right.
They had been doing funerals related to sexuality for a while, but once they started picking military funerals, we saw a much stronger national response, and so I was really also interested in why communities respond to certain kinds of pickets in some ways, and why we started getting laws regulating pickets at funerals. Mm-hmm. Once they started picking military funerals, that kept my interest, and eventually I ended up doing 6 months of very intense study there.
Did the people in Westboro cooperate with you?
They did. Of course, as a researcher, I have to have all kinds of forms for them to fill out to make sure that my position is clear so they knew what I was doing. And they had no problem signing those forms. They were very willing to talk with me and to include me in most kinds of church activities. So on Sunday mornings, for example, when other churches would be typically be having Sunday school, they're out picketing at other churches. Then they have their service. Then there'd be maybe a potluck. Mm-hmm. Or a practice singing or something like that, or a Bible study, and I would engage in those things.
You heard Fred Phelps then several times, and I'm really curious, did every time you hear him, you get those themes of hatred and rejection?
I think that there was one sermon that I didn't think that was the main point.
Okay.
Out of dozens and dozens of sermons that I've heard. And so it really is pretty consistently a message of circling the wagons, rallying the troops, that this group belongs together and people outside of this group are hopeless. And looking, really monitoring outside groups' attacks on this group.
Mm-hmm. What did you conclude about how nationalism intersected with this kind of religious zealotry?
I think that's the bigger lesson from Westboro Baptist Church. On their own, they're interesting, but they look like such an anomaly. We might even say, well, you know, in a generation or, you know, in 100 years, they're not going to probably be here, so why study them? But what's really interesting is what they tell us about us and our responses to them. And I found that very compelling. One of the most interesting findings I found was that Westboro Baptist certainly gave us a new way of caricaturizing people who are against gay rights. But they also served as kind of a radical flank, this radical right-wing group on the spectrum of anti-gay feelings.
Mm-hmm.
They're so radical that they kind of push everybody else to looking a little bit normal.
Hmm.
And so you saw this in Topeka. When Topeka faced, for example, you know, an effort to extend gay rights in the city, mm-hmm. there'd be three sets of protesters outside City Hall, people who supported the expansion of gay rights, Westboro Baptist Church, and people who didn't support the expansion of gay rights but were quick to say, but we're not Westboro Baptist Church. We're the reasonable people who don't support gay rights.
Yeah.
And so they can look more reasonable. Then I think the data really supports this. At one point, one of the church members, J.L. Phelps, ran for city council, and also running for city council was an openly gay woman. And J.L. was very clear. She said, people in Topeka don't want to vote for somebody who's openly gay. They'd rather vote for me. And why J.L. didn't win, and she didn't win more votes than this other woman, she won more than 200 votes, which is way more than people are in the church. So that I think they were right to note that there's very much an undercurrent against gay rights. And so when we talk about why when people react to Westboro Baptist Church, they're not reacting to the anti-gay part of it. Now, some people are, and I think that more people are than used to. But it was when they started the military picketing that's when we saw efforts at both national and many mm-hmm. more states trying to regulate funeral picketing.
What was the issue at Westboro that pushed them into the protests and demonstrations about military personnel?
What they would say is that the issue comes down to the case Lawrence versus Texas, which was in 2003, and that repealed state sodomy law mm-hmm. out of Texas,
right.
And it basically said that you have a right to same-sex sexuality and same-sex contact. Westboro Baptist said at that point, when our Supreme Court said that as a nation, what we were doing is we were affirming that it was okay to be gay, and since God says it's not okay to be gay, we make ourselves an enemy of God.
Okay.
And so since as a nation we're committed to disobeying God now, we've legally put in to our Constitution that you can. And if you look back to the Old Testament, anytime somebody is an enemy of God, their military is going to lose. And so it doesn't matter if individual soldiers support gay rights, because these soldiers are defending a country that is committed to being the enemy of God. God will destroy our military. Therefore, they're going to picket military funerals. And Shirley Phelps Roper told me, well, we just never knew it would get such a response when we picketed military funerals. And of mm-hmm. course, a military funeral is such a tender moment, the sense that we all have an investment in our servicemen and women. And so it's different than other kinds of funerals, but it really struck such a nerve. And it also isolated them from the last Christian groups that didn't think it was appropriate to picket at the funerals of gay people, but certainly didn't agree with the heart of Westboro's message about gay people. But mm-hmm. now they could not accept that about soldiers. And in fact, the ACLJ, which is kind of like a mm-hmm. Christian version of the ACLU, when Westboro Baptist picketed at Matthew Shepard's funeral, the college student who was gay, who was beaten to death in mm-hmm. Wyoming, the city of Casper put up a 50-foot picketing barrier, mm-hmm. saying you can't get closer than 50 feet to the funeral. And Westboro Baptist said, that's perfectly legal, that's acceptable, we have no problem. Well, the ACLJ filed a brief saying, no, that's a violation of religious freedom, we can't have that kind of 50-foot barrier. And when Westboro started picketing military funerals, the ACLJ stepped in and said, we need funeral barriers. We have to keep these people away from funerals. It's the same group making two absolutely different arguments based on who was the target. And that's where I see that nationalism coming in. And it's also nationalism that assumes that none of our soldiers are gay or lesbian and that soldiers deserve protections that other citizens don't. And that's what we get really upset about.
Why has the media given them the attention they have? They really would have been far less apparent had the media not focused on them.
I'm not sure exactly that's the case. I mean, I think they are committed for their own reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would say they have to do this because God tells them to do it.
They would still have been there even if the cameras weren't.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
But we don't know. You know, we didn't get to run that scenario because the cameras are always there.
Yeah.
But they're very media savvy. You know, even their primary slogans fit so nicely on a placard that you short words,
sure.
you can read them from the roadside.
Yeah.
For a small church, they have a pretty high quality production values in their media. And so they tell us a story that's, of course, shocking and offensive. There's a lot of other shocking and horrible images of racism, for example, that mm-hmm. we still don't put on television.
Sure.
And I think in some ways we continue to be tolerant of anti-gay language, even if we're just saying, well, let's look at this from a journalistic perspective. I'm not sure that we would look at, for example, racist comments the mm-hmm. same way. That probably speaks a little bit to our willingness to allow those things to be said at all.
Rebecca, according to the news reports we've heard over the last few weeks. Obviously, there was a breakup within the congregation, and the language used was that Fred Phelps was excommunicated from the church, which would mean that his family members and some of his children would have been involved in that. Do you have a perspective on that?
I'm really befuddled by that for a lot of reasons. The information comes to us from Nate Phelps, mm-hmm. and it's been confirmed by his brother Mark, both of whom have been out of the church for more than a generation. And that kind of came in two parts, one that Fred was ill and near to death, which ended up being true, and one that he had been excommunicated, and the church would use the word excluded.
Would it also be a denunciation of his beliefs?
Yes. It has two parts. It has a theological part,
right,
that his belief is wrong, and it would have a pragmatic part of physical exclusion. And that's how it's worked for everybody else who has been excluded. You know, they are removed from the premises, mm-hmm. and they are not considered theologically disorderly. They're
so
walking in a disorderly way.
Does that mean, then, that the church is going to go in a new direction?
I am so hesitant to predict, because it looks so unbelievable that Fred Phelps would have been kicked out of the church he founded. And so I'd be very cautious with claims like that, and it's likely that we might never know. Some theories would be that there was an internal dispute, but it seems odd to me that he would be the only person who would have left based on that. And if other people would have left, why they would not be saying something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, usually in any church, if there's a rift, it just doesn't end up being one person against, you know, 39 people.
Right.
So I don't know what that rift would have looked like. I don't know if it would be enough to truly exclude him. It's hard to imagine what the church would do next, tactically anyway. You know, once they went after soldiers, which is such a tender spot, of course, they victims of national disaster and violence. They have anti-Jewish picketing that they do now. I don't know if they're running out of targets, and so this is a different way of kind of upping the pressure. The rumor is that they have moved to a board of elders that's all male. This has been a church that, like many churches, is led by men, but really much of the work. I don't think in Westboro Baptist Church, I think everybody worked, otherwise you weren't part of the church, but that included the women. So that would be a real shift in perspective there. And there is a sense, too, you know, these are large families. Many families have 8, 9, 10 children. But if half your children leave, you still have 5 children who stay, let's say.
Yeah.
5 leave. There's still a lot who stay, but it's a lot who leave, too. And I don't know if there's some kind of tipping point at which you say, you know, this is just, it's just too hard to watch so many people I love walk away.
Rebecca, what do I need to know that you know that I haven't asked you?
People leave Westboro Baptist Church. In fact, Fred Phelps Sr. had 13 children. 9 of them remain in the church. But almost all of those 9 left the church at some point and then came back. When we see Westboro Baptist members, if you see them on the street, we don't know what they're thinking about, why they're choosing to be there. I once witnessed maybe a 14-year-old girl from the church really getting harassed at a gay pride parade by some college-age boys who were just ridiculing her. They are asking questions, and we, if you want to extend grace and kindness to them, you should let them ask those questions. Because that's how people grow, that's how people change, is by asking those questions and leaving those doors open. It's hard to leave this church because you'll be leaving everything you know, your identity, and you've made huge sacrifices to be there. So if you change your mind, you have to be able to walk into something that's safe and welcoming.
Dr. Rebecca Barrett Fox is visiting professor at Arkansas State University. Her dissertation is titled, Pray Not for These People for Their Good, Westboro Baptist Church, the Religious Right, and American Nationalism. Dr. Barrett Fox, I appreciate so much your being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
I'm happy to be here.
From the Black Red Forest to the Gulf Stream Water.
The lack of clean water is a global crisis and a moral outrage. Good work is being done to make things better, but for most of us, the numbers can be overwhelming. My next guest came up with a surprising answer to the question, But what can I do to help? With March 22nd designated as World Water Day, I'm very pleased to welcome Allie Eastburn, founder of the charity With This Ring, to State of Belief Radio. Allie, welcome.
Thank you so much.
I would like for you, if you will, start with the story of how you became a water activist.
I was at a women's retreat, and a question was asked, how can we change the world around us? And for the first time, I realized that I had a lot of stuff. I had a lot of wealth. So I looked down and noticed how big my diamond ring was. And so I spoke up and I said, what if we sold some of our stuff and used it to help the poor? And that was sort of the beginning of a conversation that I had with God later that night. And I realized that, gosh, if I sold my wedding ring, I bet I could maybe do a whole lot.
What happened in the retreat when you said, what if we do this?
Well, it was pretty quiet.
I bet.
It was kind of quiet, but
yeah.
A woman did come up to me afterward, and she said, you know, thank you for sharing. And at the time, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I just felt like God was definitely calling me to do more, and so I said, I bet if I sold my ring, I could maybe feed an entire village in Africa. And then about 3 weeks before that, my husband had said, did you know that, you know, there are many people, millions and millions of people in the world that don't have clean drinking water? And I'm kind of embarrassed to say I really never looked at the issue before. I knew it was out there, but I didn't know how serious. And so when this whole thing came up and I felt like God was really tugging on my heart, I said, you know, it's got to be water. So the ring was meant to help drill a well in Africa. Mm. But a friend of mine heard about it, and she said, you know, you can have my ring too. And it wasn't even, we weren't trying to start anything, but before I knew it, there were women calling me and saying, hey, we want to donate our wedding ring. I had no idea that we would go past the one well. I had no idea we'd end up in eight countries drilling wells either.
Yeah. How much does it cost to drill a well in Africa?
Well, that depends on where you're drilling.
Uh-huh.
There are many different areas in Africa. Some have very little difficulty getting water. So you can go as low as, say, $7,000, uh-huh. $7,500 for it's a deep water well, but it's not the depth that you would have to go in some areas in Africa. You might have to go 1,000 feet.
Uh-huh.
Those can run you $50,000. But those actually service a whole lot of people,
yeah.
Thousands and thousands of people, because at that level, at that depth, they have to put multiple spigots. I mean, it's just, It services a lot of people. So we haven't done one of those. We do the typical well, you know, with the hand pump.
Uh-huh.
Typically 150 to 300 feet down, and those cost roughly $7,000, $7,500.
And what do you know about that first investment? Because my guess is that when you learned how much that little money helped people, that probably inspired you even more.
It did, and it's kind of funny because when I first became a Christian at 21 years old, I said, God, I will never do two things. I will never go to Africa, and I will never marry a pastor. Well, I married a pastor. And before I knew it, you know, as soon as this whole thing happened, I set off for Africa with my husband. And looking for the area that we wanted to drill was really interesting because I got to meet the people and I got to see the poverty level that they were living. And I got to see sickness and disease. I got to see a disease, trichoma, this giant, you know, tumor growing out of the eye. It's a parasite. Mm-hmm. I got to see guinea worm, a large, large worm that goes in the body. It's 8 to 10 feet long. And I got to see all of these water parasites, and I thought, my gosh, people are young people, babies, children. The death rate for children under the age of 5 is so high in Africa. And so seeing that for the first time was shocking to me.
What size was the village that you ultimately drilled in?
The first village that we drilled in was probably around 500 people.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found in that area, we call it Yendi, it's a whole region. What we found in that area was that there were about 90,000 people with no access to clean water.
Mm-hmm.
So we started with one, and our goal was in that area was to do 20. We ended up doing 17, and then we had to pull out of the area because there were problems with drill rigs and problems with getting the machines, you know, that deep into the bush.
This whole concept with this ring is about radical giving. And I'm curious, how has the radical giving changed people's lives, including yours?
That is a great question. It's completely rocked my world. Going into this, I thought, well, I have a wedding ring. It's worth a lot of money. I'll sell it. but that was just the tip of the iceberg. For me, that was the start of radical, but for me, the depth of it, and it's still going, was realizing how much excess we have and how if we simplify and we alter the way we live, we can literally save the lives of people on the other side of the world that have no hope. And so what started with a wedding ring quickly became, you know, altering my lifestyle in other areas as well. Mm-hmm. So I would say to that question, you know, we cannot solve the world's water crisis by giving a one-time check. We can solve it by banding together and partnering together and altering the way we live so that we can earmark that money to bring clean water to people on the other side of the world. It does change you. And I'm not talking about giving your leftovers or what you can afford to give. I'm talking about giving till it hurts. So you have to change the way you live so that you can afford to give the way you want to give. That's radical.
You are talking about a fundamental change in the way people live.
Yes.
Have you seen that in some other people happening as well?
Oh, yes. It's amazing. I mean, we have so many stories, and some of the people that started out with a wedding ring, we've seen the depth of where their love has gone. One woman in particular that I just talked with recently, we've become friends. She is a doctor and a gynecologist, and she started out giving what she felt like she could give. Now she gives away 75% of what she makes, and she has a saying, work like a doctor, live like a nurse. You know, she goes to these countries and she helps, but she's donating 75% of everything she makes, and she's having to learn, you know, she's had to live on a budget because the 25% doesn't stretch as far as what she had before.
Sure.
But she's made that decision because she sees the need, and it is changing her as well. And she is an agent for change with other women. You know, it's contagious. When this happens to one, it happens to many.
Among people who embrace this commitment, what does that do about building community?
Most of the people, I'm out in Orange County, California, but most of the people that have gotten involved with us here, you know, I've become close friends with, you know, we all have a circle of influence around us. So if you think about 10 women who are being transformed, you put 100 people on each of those 10 women, now you have 1,000. And then when you get into the expanded circle of influence, we're talking about thousands and thousands of people that are being exposed to this idea that we can do more if we are willing to alter our lifestyle and be transformed so that we can help other people. So, yes, it's a tight community, and it's not just California. I mean, we have friendships with people all over the U.S., and we've actually started with this ring regional office in Georgia, Cartersville, Georgia, and that was a conversation and a friendship that I struck up with a woman that emailed and wanted to donate her wedding ring. And she actually decided after she wrote in that she couldn't do it because she hadn't asked her husband yet. And so when I wrote her and said, how can I help? She wrote back and said, you know, scratch that. I can't donate it because my husband's offended. And I wrote back and I said, well, that's okay. But, you know, can you tell me your why? And she said, yes. She said, my why. And she gave me this beautiful letter. But her top thing was, Jesus is thirsty and I want to give him water with my best. And I thought, wow, what a thing to say. So we've become great friends, and we just actually hired her. She's on staff, and we're calling her our radical giving ambassador in Georgia.
Well, Ali, obviously you're into transformation of individuals here as well as doing something radically helpful overseas. Does anybody make this change apart from personal conversation, or does it happen over the internet?
It happens in every way imaginable. Sometimes a woman will write in or a man will write in and he'll say, you know, or she'll say, this has already been on my heart and I went looking for you. Like, they didn't hear about us. They went looking for us because God put it on their heart to give their wedding rings. And so sometimes they don't even know we exist. They just go looking for an organization that does what we do and they find us.
Yeah.
So I'll say to that, people come and they get to this place sometimes without us having anything to do with it. It is always, in my opinion, it is always the hand of God that moves on a person's heart, because this is so, you know, against what our culture does. You know, we're about stuff and we're about instant satisfaction and gratification, and we love our houses and our stuff. And so when someone comes to this place, I don't believe it can happen from a human being. I don't think we have that much power to influence people, but I don't think a person can see that deeply into their own soul without God really helping them to see it.
Yeah.
So.
Ali, what are the goals that you've set for yourself and the ministry that you've developed?
Personally, my husband and I want to live more simply. We began to simplify our lives. Our house actually goes up for sale this weekend. We're having an open house, and so it's pretty exciting to us that for the first time we're actually able to and have agreed on the lifestyle we want to live, and it's complete opposite of what we're living now. And so that has been a goal of mine for the last 8 years. Unfortunately, we bought our house when it was, you know, at the top of the market, and the market crashed, so we had to wait out the wave to where we could sell our house. But now that we're sort of back where we are, it's a very exciting to us that we're able to simplify. So that's been a big goal for us personally, and I'm excited to see what that looks like. We're planning on taking our 10-year-old to Africa this summer with us, and that's very exciting because we want our entire family to do what we're doing. We want them to have a love for other people, to be others-centered instead of self-centered. So that's our personal goal. And as an organization, you know, our mission statement is we envision communities that champion the giving and receiving of faith, hope, and love through intentional generosity. Mm. That's our goal. That's our hope. Yeah. We would like to see the face of Christianity transformed. We would like to see people in America transformed to understand that if we all are willing to alter our lifestyle and take a look at how we live and how we give, we can change world issues like, you know, the world water crisis and hunger. There is so much we can do, but it's not going to happen with us giving our leftovers. It's not going to happen with a one-time check. It's going to happen when we become so transformed that we can't not do it.
Is there a gradual approach for getting involved, or is it just a one leap of faith and you go from there?
It's both. You can leap in. You can donate your wedding ring. You can get involved. We have lots of great programs. We have a book club. We've got some different things that you can get involved in, sort of just stick your toes in the water and dive a little deeper. But we also have mission trips, and we really encourage people to come with us. We go to Central America, and we get our people on a drill rig, and we train them, not because they're going to become drillers, but we just let them sit on the drill rig and learn the basics about drilling so they can experience clean water coming out of the ground for the first time. And that is so transformative to me. If you're going to get involved and you want to really see someone transformed, get them on a mission trip. It is life-changing, better than any vacation you could possibly go on. So come on a mission trip and see for yourself what is happening in these countries and how God can use us to change the world.
If a person is looking for something to give to, why should they consider giving to Clean Water?
Without clean water, nothing else can happen. I mean, we can't build schools, we can't build churches, we can't do any of those things until women and men and children have clean water. They can't survive without it. So water comes before everything else. When you water a village, everything else is watered as well.
Ali Eastburn is the founder of With This Ring. You can learn more about the organization and about radical giving at withthisring.org. Ali, with great admiration and appreciation, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
A lot of us chuckled at presidential candidate Mitt Romney's exasperated assertion that corporations are people too, my friend. But now it's no joke. That premise is likely to be tested in a new and frightening way this coming week as the Supreme Court of the United States hears oral arguments in the Hobby Lobby case. Joining me now is Dr. J. Michelson, always a knowledgeable voice on attempts to redefine religious liberty in this country. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Pleasure as always, Walton.
You're going to be at the court for this case. Are you excited or worried?
I got to say I'm worried. Observers in the court think this is going to be a very close case. The so-called religious liberty movement really had the wind knocked out of it in Arizona with the defeat of the Turn the Gaze Away bill. But the odds are we may lose this one. And I think a lot of folks are not aware of how significant a case this could be for all of us in America.
If anybody's just listening, kind of, they really need to listen fully at this moment, because this case is a game changer. Given the wrong decision here, we'll be looking at religious liberty through entirely different lens and be going a direction this nation has not gone since its founding.
That's absolutely right. You know, everybody's in favor of religious liberty, right? Nobody's on the opposition side to that. The question is what the parameters of that are, whether I can use my religious liberty not just as a shield against others or against the government, but as a sword to actually take away other people's rights. That's the first major question of Hobby Lobby, whether religious liberty is a sword as well as a shield. Mm-hmm. The second question is whether corporations, like you said, corporations not only are people, but do they have souls? Are corporations going to go to either heaven or hell? Can they sin or can they be saved? Which sounds like a joke, but that's actually the premise, the second major point of Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby is a huge corporation. They have 21,000 employees and 550 stores around the country. They are owned by a sincerely devout religious family that has particular religious views that nobody's criticizing or calling into question. But the owners believe that their religious beliefs should now be imputed onto the company. And so as a result, the company shouldn't be required to provide contraception coverage as part of their insurance plans under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. This is a huge change. So right now, already, Obamacare has exemptions for churches, for religious organizations, and even organizations that are just religiously affiliated. So if you run a Catholic hospital, for example, you don't have to provide any kind of health insurance necessarily for your employees. The question now is whether that exemption also applies to corporations, whether corporations have a conscience, and if so, whether that conscience can be used as a sword against the rights of their employees.
You wrote in the foreword about Hobby Lobby, about how it pits religious liberty against reproductive rights. And I'd like for you to talk about that part of the argument, but I want you also, if you will, to go beyond it, because whatever the ruling is related to reproductive rights here has implications for all of the cases related to religious liberty.
Absolutely. And let's make no mistake, this is actually religion versus religion. It's not as though just religion versus some secular human rights claim on the other side. For example, you know, my religion, Judaism, contraception is fully acceptable. There's no teaching against contraception in the Jewish tradition. And in fact, by the way, about 80% of Americans think that there's absolutely no problem with contraception. What Hobby Lobby wants to do is make their owners' religious beliefs trump the religious beliefs of all of their employees. So if I'm a practicing, believing Christian and working at Hobby Lobby, and I believe that contraception is a morally correct choice for me, the owners of the company want to make that decision for me. They want to take away my right to make a religious decision and supplant it by their religious decision. And as you point out, this doesn't just apply to birth control, contraception. This also can apply to anything. So if a corporation can choose not to obey the Affordable Care Act, they should be able to not obey non-discrimination laws. So this is really the same case that we saw in Arizona with the Turn the Gaze Away law that was vetoed by Governor Jan Brewer. If a company, a large company, let's say McDonald's or Burger King, it could be any large corporation, has owners who have a particular religious view, what Hobby Lobby is arguing is that that religious view could get them out of any law at all, including a non-discrimination law. So turn the gays away or turn the Jews away or turn the mixed-race couples away. Whatever someone believes violates their religious conscience, their corporation, not just them individually, their corporation could then get out of all kinds of laws on the basis of it.
Jay, how did we get here where an individual's religious conscience can be overruled by a corporate religious conscience? How did we get here?
The main answer to that is a whole lot of skillful money and resources from a small group of very conservative Catholics and some evangelicals who are allied with them, conservative evangelicals, that is. There has been a tremendous amount of money going into organizations that listeners may not have heard of, like the Beckett Fund, the law firm that's putting forward this case, the Alliance Defending Freedom, formerly known as the Alliance Defense Fund. These organizations are working in the courts and in legislatures around the country to redefine, just like we said at the top, religious liberty, and to say that my religious liberty allows me to bully another person or to shame another person or to deny access to health care to another person. And that's really how we got here. This is a tricky case because it's also about Obamacare. Mm-hmm. And even though it has these consequences that go far beyond that context, the reality is this is not a Supreme Court that's a big fan of Obamacare. The individual mandate itself just barely survived really on a technicality in that case. And this is a court that has been willing to find rights for corporations, as evidenced by the Citizens United case about corporations having free speech rights, which is, you know, why mm-hmm. Mitt Romney could say that corporations are people. So those footnotes make this an even harder case and one that we should all be quite worried about.
This past week, I was happy to sign on to a statement from the Religious Institute, along with many other diverse faith leaders, demanding freedom of conscience for those Americans who do not believe contraception to be against their values. In fact, there are many moral arguments to be made in favor of deliberate reproductive decision-making.
You know, I only wish that I could put a megaphone in front of what you just said and that petition that the Religious Institute put around. The right is depicting this as religious people on one side and anti-religious people on the other. And that's just not true. There are a number of important positive religious values around family planning, you know, not least the impact of what it's like to bring a child into this world if you're not prepared financially or emotionally or in a relationship, if appropriate, to raise that child properly. Sometimes you hear, well, this is only about insurance coverage. You could just go out and buy contraception. You don't need insurance coverage for it. But that's not true. I mean, contraception can run between $500 and $1,000 a year, and that's a significant amount of money for folks who might be making before taxes, you know, $30,000 or $40,000 a year.
Yeah.
So it really is who has the right to make your ethical and moral health care decisions. And people of faith who don't want their bosses making those decisions for them should be outraged by the arguments that Hobby Lobby is putting forth.
Jay, you've written extensively on this concerted effort to redefine religious liberty. Help our listeners understand what some of the possible outcomes could be from this Hobby Lobby case, depending on what the court decides.
30 years ago, the court had a case from Bob Jones University, which originally barred African-Americans from applying and later changed that policy, but still barred interracial dating and had separate housing, basically had segregation into the 1970s at Bob Jones University. The court said that the IRS could take away Bob Jones University's tax-exempt status, that you can't discriminate in the name of religion. Imagine if that case had gone the other way. Imagine if Bob Jones University were allowed today to maintain a racially segregationist policy at their university and still function as a tax-exempt charity. The landscape would be completely different. This is the same argument that we're facing now. If Hobby Lobby and other large corporations like it are able to exempt themselves from Obamacare on the basis of religion, they're going to be able to exempt themselves from all the other kinds of laws as well. And it's hard for me to see as an attorney what the distinction would be between this case and another case that comes down the line, which does say, let's say, I believe that intermarriage is against my religion, therefore I won't let any multi-faith couples stay at my hotel. Or anything, you know, I'm a Muslim and I will not allow someone in my taxi cab to be drunk or to be intoxicated. So I'm going to be able to refuse people on whatever basis that I want based on my religion. Yeah. This just isn't really how democracy works. And yet we have gotten to the point where it may actually be validated by the Supreme Court.
Jay, is this case the tip of the spear in the culture wars right now? Where else did you see religious liberty language being misappropriated?
Well, it's used a lot. Not surprisingly, it's used in the same old fronts of the culture war that it's always been used in. There are some who say this is about religious liberty. This is not about religious liberty. This is about fighting the culture war, using this as a tool to do so. So the main fronts are reproductive rights, contraception, abortion, and so forth, and LGBT rights, marriage, equality, non-discrimination, and so forth. The same kind of language that's being proposed in the Hobby Lobby case was in the Turn the Gaze Away bill in Arizona, that if a corporation's owners professed a religious belief, that you couldn't sue them for discrimination, you couldn't sue them for anything else. You know, is it the tip of the spear or is it the rear guard, the cannons at the back? You know, the sort of arch-conservative right has lost the battle, not just legally, but culturally as well. There are people of faith all around the country who believe that their faith compels inclusion and acceptance, not just that it's okay to be gay, but that it's actually a positive moral value to build a world filled with love and with inclusion and acceptance. So they've lost the battle, and they're now trying to carve out spaces where the democratic process doesn't apply. And we saw this in the 1970s and 80s, and now we're seeing it all over again.
Jay, are the justices that sit in that high court as in touch as they ought to be with the far-reaching effects of this case?
You know, I generally would say that they are. I think the justices are always looking toward the future. I don't think that they're going to blunder into this decision, however it goes. And this is really going to come down to the moderates. It's going to come down a lot to just Justice Kennedy. And so you look at kind of his record on these kinds of issues. He tends to try to find some kind of a middle road. But it's tough that all of our hopes for liberty are basically riding on someone who doesn't usually find expansive definitions of liberty. Now, I don't think they're going to blunder in ignorance into this. You know, folks said before Citizens United that that case would be a game changer, and that case was a game changer.
Right.
We saw $1 billion of corporate money enter the political world after that decision came down. It actually did. I wouldn't say that the sky fell exactly, but it did permanently change, at least so far, you know, to the present day, it changed how politics is. There's a lot more super PAC money. There's a lot more negative ads, a lot more corporate voices out there in the political space. So I think if they go into this, they will see the change. They just may want to see that change.
Dr. J. Michelson is an author, activist, and public speaker. He has great insight on matters of religion and society. You may recall he's the author of God vs. Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, among other books he's written. You can follow his work at jmichelson.net. It's always great to have you on this show. I hope that you'll let us come back to you on a follow-up.
Thank you, Wilton. And I'll put in one little quick pitch right here at the end, which is that Catholics for Choice is holding a rally right on the steps of the Supreme Court on Tuesday, starting around 9 in the morning. Everybody's going to be there from both sides, and we really need faith progressives to come out in force and in numbers to support justice in this case.
I will just say you're exactly right, and I hope some of our listeners will be there. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support is essential in helping to make this show possible. Please visit stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely, I promise you, to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program. Every week, we hear from listeners across the country who say they rely on our show for the kind of inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue they can't find anywhere else. Stateofbelief.com is where you'll find out more about this show. Hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week via Facebook and Twitter. Our listener line, if you'd like to call it, is 202-681-4246. As always, we encourage you to tell others about the show and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Wilton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.